This is largely an illustrated lecture. I have a basic theory about Syria, and that is that it is underestimated. Usually when people want to see at first hand biblical antiquities, things that have to do with the Bible, they go to the Holy Land, don't they?
Right.
Presently in Israel. Some people know that you really, if you want to study the background of the Bible, should go to Jordan, Transjordan, and because a lot of it took place there, and to Egypt, weren't they in Egypt? Sinai. And certainly the Bible started with Abram, and where was Abram? Mesopotamia, and way out here. So I guess I don't have a good light on here, but if Abram came from where the Chaldees instead stayed up here, he was in Syria, and then came down here to the Holy Land. You see that? And so the Bible doesn't begin in Palestine at all. They were down in Egypt, remember that? And then they came in. And then when the Apostle Paul preaches, the last part of the New Testament goes where? Way out to Rome, and as far as Luke's account in the Acts of the Apostles, ends Paul giving the gospel to Rome. So I think it's a mistake when people simply say you should go to the Holy Land. That's very important. But I have had my eyes on Syria for a long time, never had the chance to go there until 2 years ago. I had a sabbatical, and I was living in Munich for about 4.5 months as a guest of the university there. And I found out while I was there, I hadn't made the plans before, through another man, Jörg Jeremias, that there was a German tour that was going. And it was a very well-planned tour. It was sponsored by the University of Münster in Germany. And it was led by a lady, Maria Karis Kaprot, who was an archaeologist who works regularly in Syria and knows and loves the Syrians and could just be a great leader. I might say that we flew with the Lufthansa to from Frankfurt to Damascus. It was only 9 days, but I'll tell you, she got us up every morning on the road by 8 o'clock, and she seldom got us back in the evening until 8. Well, one of the nice things is that we had our own bus, and we had our own driver and a little boy who would bring us tea and all kinds of little Arab sweets all the time. And we also had a native Syrian guide. So she took care of all the antiquities and all the no-nonsense stuff of ancient history. And he took care of not only lots of jokes, this is all in German. I speak German like English, and so this was a German group. He spoke German too. He'd been in the east zone of Germany and had gotten to know all that, even had a wife and family over there too, and then his wife in Damascus. But he told us the whole Arab thing, so when we get to a mosque or something, she wouldn't say anything, he would do that. And he told us a little about the politics. So if you came here to get the politics, that isn't what I can help you with. I'll show you a few pictures. If you ask questions, I'll tell you what I know. But I'm by no means an expert on that. So my idea is this, that we go to see several important places. And then if you have questions at any time, please raise your hand. Can you hear me well now, B?
Yes.
All right. And she has this thing in her ear for hearing well. And if you have any questions at any time, don't be afraid to raise your hand or even speak out, because we'll be turning out the lights here. And I'll usually use the slide on everything I want to say. So can we turn off the lights?
Mm-hmm.
This is a picture of the modern city of Damascus. It still is a marvelous city. And it nestles between, you can see a bit of the green there. This is my picture, it's not a very good one, but almost all my pictures here, and I'm not a great photographer, but you can see it's a well-watered oasis. Nestling, I took this from the beginning of the slopes of the Mount Hermon. And you can see the mosque down here. And you can see, of course, the modern, naturally, the modern city. You can see parts of the old city. And way back here, you can see the famous Cardo that was the Roman. It still has the main lines of the North and South Street, which is called in the book of Acts the street called Straight. You remember where Paul came and waited there. So there are a lot of antiquities, and we'll show you some of them. It has a very much of a Muslim character. This, for instance, is a mosque with the minarets here that was built by the great Saladin, the great conqueror. And it was built for pilgrims who would go on their way to Mecca. Most Christians do not understand very much of Islam, and I think that it's really almost criminal that we get all kinds of information about everything else except these countries over there, and therefore we misunderstand them. A mosque has around it a soup kitchen for all people. It has a place for people who are traveling to stay. And the Muslims have their own social enterprise system. It isn't the capitalistic one that you pay monies for motel. They have the big hotels too. But a mosque is a place of teaching. It always has a large courtyard. And it's really, when you go inside, I mean, you just only look at the place where they worship and pray, and they do a lot of that, you're missing half of the show. You have to look at what is happening round about, where they're having a school teaching the Quran, and where they're really feeding the people. Without the mosque, the people wouldn't feel at home at all. It's a very strong religion, much more strong than we imagine. We just think everything runs by power and might. Now this is the courtyard, beautiful marble here, and if you look closely, you can see that's an old architecture. That's the Umayyad Mosque. On this site, in pre-Christian times, the god Adad, like Baal, was worshipped there. Later on, Zeus was worshipped there. Christ was worshipped there. It was a Christian church. And now the god, Allah, is worshipped there. That minaret is called the Christ Minaret. And inside of the mosque, I took this picture. And it's a very long, it's a very old mosque. When the Umayyad caliphs, that's the descendants of Muhammad, ruled here, their empires stretched from Spain all the way to modern Afghanistan. This is in the early times of the times when the Muslims conquered. I might say this was taken, there's a little shrine here, from the time when it was a Christian church for John the Baptist, which is interesting. Of course, he's part of the Muslim tradition too. It's interesting that this was once upon a time when the Muslims took over. They didn't just slaughter the Christians. That's a misunderstanding. They let the Christians have the eastern part, and they had the western part of this. Can you imagine that? And they worshiped together. That was the structure that precedes this present one that you're looking at. The mosque has inside of it, and this is kind of an outside place where they kept very treasured Qurans and holy things, a lot of mosaics, and they're called golden mosaics. And because in the Muslim tradition you don't have figures of human beings, because human beings are in the image of God, and therefore you're not going to make another image, you will find them largely in floral patterns and largely pictures of paradise. And this I took myself. It's the only one. There are some nicer ones inside, but I didn't have flash and all that. And this is about the best I can do. But it shows you that way, way back, and this is in the 7th century A.D., that the Muslims had a large and a very important culture. This is what they call in Arabic a souk, a kind of a covered marketplace. The shops are on either side, and here you can see this European gal looking at us here. And this is where you do all your shopping, so just to give you a flavor of the town. And this was the palace at the time when the Ottoman Turks ruled this area. It's now been turned into a museum of Islamic life. A very interesting museum, I might say. This, by the way, is a Turkish bath. You've all heard of Turkish baths, but this is an original one, going way back into the 18th century. In fact, that fellow back there is actually changing his clothes. He changes it the way some people do on the beach, with a little towel around him, and I guess the steam rooms are off to the side. But it's a social place, as you can see. You can come and sit here, and you can smoke your pipe, your water pipe, and talk with your friends. And that is one of the old things. Maria was an extremely good guide because she knew all these places that we would never have gotten into a place like this. This is just kind of for Arabs only. Whoops, wait a second here. I have to focus that a bit better. This is that guide that I told you, the Syrian guide in the business suit. And we stopped, we left Damascus and we went out in the desert. To go in the Syrian desert on the way to Palmyra. But you'll notice that here the Bedouin who used to have camels, well, what do they have? They've got a Toyota maybe here or something like that. It's partly their old life, but partly not. And so it's changing quite quickly. And of course he was just talking and asking her a few questions. And we could kind of look in. We didn't actually go inside of the tent, but many of the people had still been living in this way. But it's modernizing itself very, very fast. Now we're getting closer to that famous oasis called Palmyra. Palm is like this, our word palm, because it was a big oasis. And outside of it, there is not only these standing tombs of the very rich merchants who lived here in Roman times, the time of Jesus. But over here, there's something they're just building up. Please come in. Here is a fort, which the Syrian tourist agency is going to make into a tourist attraction, too. Right now, it's a little hard to get up there. But we could go inside of this place, and there are a place of burial for families on various levels, and even way down in the ground. And I took this picture inside, and it, somehow or other it turned out, I have a little flash, but it turned out, and you can see, though the Muslims have defaced all these faces here of the family, of the ancestors, this was a place where they would celebrate their anniversaries of their death and things like that. And that's kind of Roman architecture. Now, Palmyra is a marvelous site, and even though it was destroyed because Queen Zenobia dared to fight against the Romans, and of course the Romans came and destroyed the whole thing, enough of it is still there in the sand so that when now the tourist agencies come and they build up, raise those columns and some of the, even sometimes a temple, you can get an idea of an ancient town the way, for instance, Antioch must have been when St. Matthew lived there, or let's say when St. Paul came to these places. So we have a pretty good idea of it. This comes from a tour brochure by the Ministry for Tourism. I picked it up in Munich, that's why it happens to be in German. But it's the best picture that I have of a tremendously large temple area. Can you see this? This is the actual temple itself where the god Baal was worshipped, and this is the extent of it. So when you compare that to what King Herod at about the same time built in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, you could see that they would have a temple, but then a very large extent round about it. And of course, here's the modern road. You can see that. Please come in. And here is the large main center and there are shops along each side of it. I'll show you a British reconstruction of that. And then this is the center where the north-south and the east-west road kind of came together. And then here would be the amphitheater, and over here is another temple to the god, and then over here you would have the place where the merchants came, and of course you had camel trains coming from the desert. You can see part of the oasis here. and coming all the way from the east. So it was a tremendously large place. Now we'll go on the ground, and you can see how very nicely it's, here's that arch. They built that when the Roman Emperor Hadrian came here, and they have consoles here where they would have statues of the important men at the time. I took this picture right underneath where the north, south, and east-west roads come together. And here's from the original British publication. The British did the first archaeological work of what it might have looked like when each one of those senators and rich merchants that lived out there had his consul, and when people lived there in the Roman times. And it's like a mall, isn't it? Like our malls today. And you, in the winter time, you would be protected from the winds and so forth. And in the summertime, it would be cool. And they could go into these various public buildings. And it was a marvelous town. It's a kind of a ghost town, because after it was destroyed, naturally, this is all modern reconstruction. These are modern things put up there, but it shows what they call in Greek a tetrapylon, a four sort of a gate, and there's an altar here, an incense to the various gods and goddesses that protected the city. And that's our group down there, and I think we saw a picture of Maria. You'll see some other pictures of her, and it's beautiful work, and today with that rich color, it's a very nice tourist attraction. This would be what it looked like originally. You see, you were only seeing this part of it, and maybe it had sides here, and tremendously large and impressive place way out there in the desert, where these kind of an oasis in the desert, kind of a harbor for the camel trains. And this is the stage of that theater. It's rather beautiful, isn't it? And this is where some of the ancient dramas of the Greek tragedians, the Roman tragedians, and they had some of their own, began to be played. That was part of the entertainment of the people. As for that very large temple, this it was a large temple area. This is the actual cella building itself. And you can see part of it has been preserved. You see, what happened is that after the Romans destroyed this, the people didn't build the whole thing up again, but they moved into this one center and made that their town. So that once was a Christian church. And then it was a mosque, and now it's been made the tourist attraction. And you can go inside, and I actually, at the risk of my life, took this picture, climbing way up one top of it, and you can see what was inside of it here. This would be where the statue of the god Baal would be, that was worshipped there. And there are still some signs of the zodiac and of the stars up above inside of it. And here's a procession. This is from the archaeologist's book here, but the Britisher's book. But you can see here that they have taken, almost like in Jerusalem, where you had the ark. Didn't you have the ark was carried by the priests? And that was the movable throne in which God sat invisibly. And here you have something similar that they had in their worship, a procession of worshipers coming from the inside of that small little temple that I showed you. Now they're going way out. And I suppose they'll maybe carry this on a great procession, maybe through the town. It's a really a marvelous sort of thing to see that whole thing. Remember, this is that great big temple of Baal. It's still really large, isn't it, after all these years? And there's that main columns there. And there were all kinds of places, marketplaces. Each one of the Roman emperors, after the Romans conquered this, they stationed their troops there. And for instance, the Emperor Diocletian, he had this whole section here, which he gave the money for. And that's where his soldiers would come together. Now, the next thing shows us a rather important place called Dura Ropus. It's just cut off here. This is the Euphrates River along here. And from Yale University, a man by the name of Kraling did
together with other scholars, did a lot of excavation there. And this is where they found, well, oodles and oodles of, as you can see, all kinds of temples, Christian churches, the Agorist Center, Roman camp. What we'd like to show you, and now important, is we'll come through this gate here. We'll see some Arab boys here. And then two things. One is where there had been a Jewish synagogue, and over here, the second thing I want to show you is where there was a Christian church. Now, in the 3rd century, in fact we know the date, 273, before there was going to be some invasion of by some Parthians, people from modern Iran, to protect these walls and fortify them, they simply commandeered this whole street here, and they covered all the buildings here carefully, especially the synagogue, because it had beautiful paintings in it, and thus preserved it. And they preserved this little Christian house church, too. And that's the oldest house church that we have any archaeological evidence for, which is rather surprising. So those are the two things we want to see. Well, this wasn't our bus, it's some other bus. There were other tourists there. Went through this gate here, and these boys, they're high schoolers. I'm sorry that I should have made them go to the other side and I could have had the sun shining in their eyes. But that's typical Syrian high school boys. Can you look at them closely? They were, and by the way, an American still causes a sensation. They like Americans. Isn't that interesting after all the propaganda? And so here I was the only American among these Germans, and when somehow they found out about that, I had to take this picture. It was, they called it, well, March 21st. It was the first day of spring. But in Arabic, you call that Mother's Day. And so they didn't have to go to school. And so they were singing and kind of dancing and so forth. They're quite well educated. And we should not imagine that they are all just ignorant terrorists. Not at all. Anything but that. Well, this is that ancient wall, and it was right down here. This was the street that was kind of covered for purposes of fortifying it better. And right down here was where that Jewish synagogue was. Now, the Yale University archaeologist took that to the museum in Damascus, and it's there. Except that because it's Jewish, you have to ask permission to go down there and look at it, which is shows the kind of the animosity between the Arabs and the Jews. But it's still there, and if you want to ask, they'll let you see it. It's public as far as that's concerned. Now, this comes from some of the publications by Yale University. These are only houses, but here's where the Jewish synagogue was. And notice that it has an outward courtyard where they could gather, and then the House of Assembly is the actual synagogue itself. And way in the background is where they put the Torah, that's pointing toward Jerusalem. In fact, you can see it right here. This is kind of the most important thing. They would have the scroll of the books of Moses, and that would be kind of a very great shrine. And what is very important is you have, for instance, here is Ezra reading a scroll. Can you imagine that? Just the way they would read the Bible. This is part of the temple, and here are stories about Esther. But what I'd like to show you in color, something we talked about today in the Bible class, about Ezekiel and the dry bones. And I have some colored pictures of that, and I'd like to show you that, because it shows how Jews thought of that story in Ezekiel 37. Here you've got Ezekiel, and the Lord is doing what? Carrying him. Remember, the hand of the Lord came out and took him up and carried him in the spirit to wait to see what was happening far away. And here he saw those bones. You remember the dry bones. And here you have, now watch this, in dark color. Over here, that's the new epoch. This is the old epoch, before the resurrection. And so here you have Israel and Judah, the north and south kingdoms. And each time something happens, the hand of God shows that something is happening. You see, it's kind of like a children's picture story. It's not the way we do it. And in this case, the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem is split in two. And that's in the prophet Zechariah 14. Because you see, Mount Zion should be the highest mountain. But if you go to Jerusalem today, that Mount of Olives is higher. So the prophet said, in the days are coming when, well, you know that from Isaiah 2, when the hill of the mountain of the Lord will be the highest of all mountains, and all nations shall flow to it. You remember that? It's going to be the highest thing in which all nations come. Well, here's the beginning of that. What happens? With a great big seismos, an earthquake, at the end of time, what happens? Part of this mountain goes to the north, and part of it goes to the south, and Mount Zion becomes the greatest. And actually, this is cut off in the slide I have. It's way over here in pictures, Mount Zion standing alone as the greatest mountain. And here, look at all these bodies are coming out, and with the help of the Messiah. Here they actually pictured the Messiah on the walls of their synagogue with the help of the four angels from the four winds, just what we have in our lesson this morning, taking all these bodies and putting them back together for the resurrection. And here they are resurrected. This is Israel. There's another figure on this side of Judah. And then you've got the rest of the 12 tribes. And that's the way they pictured it. It's kind of interesting. So I suppose people conceived on the basis of Ezekiel 37, that when the end time came, the old epoch would be done and the new epoch would come and we'd have the resurrection. In other words,
do you think the south, let's say the north is smaller than the south?
Well, don't you know that Jerusalem is in the south and is much more important than Israel? And the 10 tribes from Israel, they never got back. And so Judah is the most important. In fact, that was the only one that remained. That's why we say today people from that part, those are Jews. You see that? In the tribe of Judah. There was actually Benjamin, too. St. Paul was very happy and boasted that he was a Benjaminite. That he was from that tribe that supported Judah. I think that's the reason. We don't know, you see that. But that's all we find. Now, let's look at the Christian house. You see, the Christians weren't as wealthy as those Jews. So they had just taken over what? A house with a courtyard in the center. See that? In fact, they had taken to make a place for their altar and for the Christian assembly. They had removed one of the walls here. And so if you came into that worship place from outside, you came through this vestibule, and you went out here, and here is a portico. You could talk with your friends here before service and after service. And over here was a library with the archaeologists found parts of scrolls there. So that must have been where they had a cupboard to keep the scrolls of the various parts of scripture. They had a schoolroom over here for teaching people who wanted to become Christians, kind of catechetics. But they had a place for going upstairs here. The biggest and most decorated place was the baptistry. It was extremely important. And here, though they didn't have any pictures in these other places, in that place they have pictures. And I'll show you how that's built up. This would be the south wall, and it's going down here toward... Now you have to be careful here now I say this. Is this big enough to dunk them? Like the Baptists say you should do, all the way down, or do they just stand in this and have water? But this is a pillar, and then look at the south, and this is the same thing, only now looking in the north wall, and here's that same thing. You can see how big it is, and they must have had some sort of baptisms inside of here, and they must have stood there, and they have pictures here. Can you imagine what they have here? They have the tomb of Jesus, and they have Easter, the three Marys, coming, the sun is just rising, so it's Easter morning. And over here, you can guess this, the healing of the paralytic. You remember the man who was paralyzed? And then the ship on the sea, the sailing. So they had stories, but their artistry isn't as great. They weren't as rich, these Christians, as the synagogue was. This is the oldest Christian church that we have. From the Reader's Digest book, a very nice book called Great People of the Bible and How They Lived, there is a reconstruction.
And they got a lot of criticism, those guys from Reader's Digest, because they have here an infant baptism. And, you know, there are many people who say, no, it should only be adult baptism. You ever see that? But the artist who they commissioned, we don't have a picture of how they did it. But I think you could have infant baptism. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. My think is that most of the people were converted as adults, and they stood there, and they poured water over the top, like you often see in pictures of them. And I would agree with the Baptists that you can't prove that. But here, this is the tomb, and here are the Marys coming, sun rising, and here's the paralytic. You don't see that quite as well here. And various Bible stories, we might say, that are pictured on the wall. So they had some of them, but it wasn't as nice as there. So there are a lot of things that can be found in Syria because it was preserved. Now if you go way down in Syria, and here's our leader, Maria, and there were a lot of tourists there, to a place called Mari, you find an ancient city which was very important because it gives us the life at the time of Abraham. And we know that Abraham lived in this area. And in this city they found all kinds of cuneiform tablets. One of my colleagues at Concordia College in River Forest, Illinois, where he used to teach, did his doctoral dissertation on all this background material, because it sheds light when you have an ancient city like this on the sort of work that was, or life that was there. The French did a nice thing there. They've been excavating here year after year. They put these plastic kind of domes here to kind of shade it. Because you see, otherwise, once you dig into a city like that, and erosion comes, if you don't protect it from the weather or something like that, it erodes away. Another thing is good, that when the Hammurabi, the king of Babylon, came and took this place, he burned it. And what did that do? The fire practically made all those bricks, like we would say, a proof against erosion. And so this is well preserved. When we could walk into this down here, we were walking into an ancient place that was just there like the time of Hammurabi. Here you can see how well they did this, these French people. I took this from the side later, and this was the courtyard inside. Later on I'll show you a reconstruction of the whole thing. Because, you know, once those archaeologists are done digging, it's a mess, isn't it? But in this case, it's not. There you can see the throne room itself. So we actually were standing. Here's Maria, and here's our a German group. And this is the background. This is where you had sort of temple area, and over here was a place where there was throne room, and it was almost as if you would have ambassadors coming from Babylon coming right into the place. It's 2,000 years before Christ. And in that courtyard, the open part here, along this wall here, they found a lot of murals that were carefully preserved by the French. And so we have an idea of many of the processions that went on in this very place itself. This is a modern reconstruction. Our tour came right through here, and that's the first place you see. It's lighted here. And the first archaeologists didn't realize that, and they thought they were just open courtyards. There are some open courtyards like this one or this one here, but here are all those nice inscriptions that the French preserved. And this is the oldest part of the temple. If in the days when it was the biggest temple, they would come in here, you'd have to kind of cool your heels here for a while. If you got permission and had the right credentials as an ambassador, you might get into this courtyard. Here was a small throne room for a certain reason. If you could get into the private parts here, this is where the storehouses were, and this is the private places where the king and emperor would live. And this was another throne room, we just talked about that, and here's another second throne, and that's that large courtyard.
And this was, these were temples over here. So we have a pretty good idea of how people lived at that time. And if we study that, it gives us at least some clues as to customs. Well, now getting back to reality, this is a place called Raqqa, quite an important place in Muslim history. And this is the way people live. And they are not wealthy, comparatively poor, but Syria is the only nation back in the Near East that has stood up to Israel, even militarily, and fought several rounds with it. Usually by that time they have a truce. And I think you must realize that if you have 100 million Arabs surrounding little Israel, and these people are not going to go away, that there's a big problem for Israel in the future. And if Israel did not economically and otherwise militarily, it's far stronger in its army and navy than any of these, and all of them put together, but potentially, and that's what the Jews are afraid of. They don't want to give them even a foot. And that's why Shamir and these really hardliners who now run the government of Israel are afraid. And I think they perhaps have a reason to. Now, we as tourists then went out to see many things. This is an ancient Byzantine church. And it has an architecture which later churches, including our Western churches, never had. For instance, this place up here is where the clergy sat in the middle of the congregation. Usually you've got the clergy up next to the altar, isn't it, sitting behind there. And here the bishop has to sit in the midst of the people, which is a different sort of architecture than we ever expect. That was early Syrian Christianity. At the time when this was built, it was for Saint Sergius, is one of the great saints for the Russian Orthodox Church, Sergius. Sergei is one of the big names up there in Russia. So this is the time when, before the Muslims took over, when a good share of this was Christian. And they had very long and very important architectures here. Well, now just a few of the modern things. That's the Euphrates River with a dam built with Russian help at that time. And it's called the Assad Dam after the name of their present dictator, Assad. And they have flooded this whole area, and they have electricity. Of course, it helps them in modern development. You remember they did that down in Egypt, too. They built the Aswan Dam down there. This is not a mixed... this is a mixed blessing, I should say. It's not just great, because... like many of our dams, even in this country, and they have much less control of this, this causes problems. It's caused great problems in Egypt, upset the whole ecology. And so they may be jumping into the modern world the worst way possible. And so some people are criticizing him. This is a picture, or a statue, of Assad with all the people. He belongs to that Arab Bata party, which wants the Arabs to be ruled democratically and socially. He's not a communist, but he's a socialist. And therefore doesn't want to have this ruled by some descendant of Mohammed. And since most of his people are Sunni, very conservative Muslims, he doesn't have the problem that you'd have with Khomeini and the Shiite Muslims. And so it's a very stable place. In Damascus, I might say, I'm going up the hills once in toward Mount Lebanon, we went past his palace, and it's a fortress. He's a dictator, no doubt about that. But in a sense, a benevolent dictator. And I'm quite surprised that Bush and he get along very well, and Baker, in trying to get this new peace process going, if they can ever get the hardliners in Israel to say yes to it. Well, you've perhaps all heard about Aleppo, haven't you? It's in all the books and Shakespeare and whatnot. And this is the entrance to the citadel at Aleppo. This is from Muslim times, medieval times. If we could go into this buried city here, boy, we'd find all kinds of stuff. But of course, it's still used, and
I don't know when anybody would ever give permission for archaeologists to do archaeology work. If they did, they would find an awful lot. But nearby, they did find things. There is another big mosque in Aleppo. Here it is. And it's beautiful. Not as good as nice as that one in Damascus. By the way, these are people in black are German women. They couldn't go into that mosque unless they had put on all these kind of monk's clothing and went in. That was not permitted otherwise. But then they could go in, and it was a very interesting place. The mosques, and they have them all over, extremely important, the very center of their life. And that's why we should understand it. Here is Maria and our Syrian guide, and one of the members of our German party. And here is the entrance to the Aleppo Museum. And that has all kinds of the artifacts that all the archaeologists dug up. They dug up an awful lot between World War I and World War II. And here's what we had in Ezekiel. Didn't we have these various monsters and various people with various heads, hybrid creatures? And then on top of each one of them was what? A deity. And these deities pulled up, in this case, the entrance to that museum. That's the way they made this modern museum. It's a rather interesting thing. Any of you that saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia, he lived up here in Aleppo for a long time. Now, nearby is a place called Ebla. And Ebla is a Italian excavation. And in the square next to the palace, the throne platform of the King of Ebla was found. And what these Italian people have done is they've kind of preserved all these things, even though this is out open underneath the sky. They also have the entrance up here to go up into the private quarters of the king. These were posts, or where posts once stood as an awning over the top, so that when people came here and the king would have to have an audience or make presentations and give his presentations and maybe have to decide some cases of law, he would come out here and sit here. Here you can also see they had been excavating underneath here, also going up into the palace, and this is what we just saw down there. You see, this would be the courtyard, but they still left that stand here because it takes so much work. You don't have bulldozers to get it out. And if they want to take it an archaeological site, you have to take down carefully every single square foot of this and sift it to find out what is there. So that would take a lot of time. So they went after the gold first and went to this palace. And they went down into these sections here and they found some rather interesting things, especially a library. And the library enables us, and this comes from the National Geographic, I just got columns, to kind of see what happened. In this case, we have Naram Sin. This is early Syrian history, even before the time of Abram. He comes from Acca, that's the southern Iraq, and he comes as a conqueror, killing all the people that were there and putting them, this is the artist's idea, as prisoners being killed. Here's the actual courtyard. We just kind of saw that here and going up here, but now they're plundering this and they're taking off all the booty. This conqueror comes from Akkad, from Iraq. And that's maybe the way the place looked. It was a very large city. And you see you have your entrance places here, roads, and this would be the palace, and this is what we saw out here in the center. So it gives us a pretty good idea. We don't know of everything in a city like that. The excavators in Bex, they can excavate only in certain spots. If they tried anywhere here, they might just run into rubbish. But they'll try to excavate these various gates and the palace and the temples that they would find. And here is the original, notice how a stairway going up to the palace, how nicely it is. It was so easy to walk up there, and I said to myself, boy, this is easier than most of the places where you have to walk up and you have to really have big, but I suppose these are a very formal thing for the king and the people who belong to the palace to go up there. And the side rooms here is where they found the library. And this is again a reconstruction from the National Geographic of a man who is a librarian. And here he's got one of those books. And this has been excavated, and it tells us a tremendous amount of history before the time of Abraham. Now we'll have a change of pace. This is an air view of a famous Christian shrine where Simon Stylites, the man who stood on the top of a great pillar, for they said, some people said 20 years, some people even said 40 years. He was a monk, and he was so ascetic that gradually built, while he was still living here, people came here, and then after a while the emperor gave a lot of money to build a large church. Most of it has been carried away as building material for the people, but there isn't a great population here, so a lot of it is there. The monks had their own church here, and they had their monasteries over here, and this would be a place of pilgrimage for the early Byzantine Christians. From this French magazine that I have, you can see how you'd enter down here. And if you hadn't been baptized before, you better get baptized here or you can't get in. This is for the pilgrims here, and this would be the monastery here, and this would be the large church, very large church, with the pilgrim church here. And this is the cloister church, I was wrong. This is the pilgrim church and that's the cloister church. And then the community center. But now when I show you even the remains, you must look how beautifully it's built. Isn't that nice architecture? And most of the tourists there, by the way, were native Syrians. And you can see they're quite well dressed. They're certainly not hurting. I met a number of Texas oil drillers out there in the places where we would stay. And boy, did they like the Syrians. And they said they got oil, too. So I don't know whether they can get it onto the world market. But if Assad has oil, well, then he's in business, like most of those Arab countries. But look at the beautiful architecture. Isn't that nice? As nice as you'd find up in the capital city of Constantinople, or Byzantium, they called it at that time. It's modern Istanbul. And here's all that's left of that great big pillar that was there. The tourists always chopped more off of it, and so there isn't very much left, and they all take it home and make magic out of it. And there's the Pilgrim's Church. Not far away from this place, they found part of a Roman road. That would be the type of road on which the Apostle Paul rode. That's quite a nice bit of construction, isn't it? The Romans knew, the engineers just knew how to build roads, and they built them from one end of the Rome to the other. Of course, they built them largely for military and economic purposes, but here in this part of Syria, some of them are still preserved. Rather surprising. And that was a native market. It's not like our malls, is it? Though they are poor, there's no question about that. But they love their markets, and they've got a lot of kids. And Israel will try to catch up now with them by getting all the Soviet Jews. But in the long run, the boys that worked with me archaeologically, when we had a section of the ancient city, they'd say to me, when were the Yehudi here? When were the Jews here? And I'd say, from this section to that section. Oh, they'd laugh and they'd say, all Arabs above, all Arabs below, we'll beat them anyway. But they aren't having such an easy time now with the hardliners in Israel. But that's the way people live out there. And I think we ought to have more documentaries of how people really live and what they really think. So often we get just these little minute clips, and it's fast food, and you can't learn much about the world if you just have it too fast. I think our news media are, we have some good news media, but they're delinquent. They don't tell us everything. When the Crusaders came here, they built a lot of castles, and they built them just like they built them, doesn't that look like it's in France or something like that? The architecture is the same sort of thing. This is a Croque de Chevalier. This, now we're getting away from Aleppo, getting toward the Mediterranean Sea. And this is my last slides. Here we've come to a very important place called Ugarit or Ras Shamra. It was a capital city about the same time when Jerusalem under David became a capital city. And it isn't as nice, it isn't as photogenic, because it's close to the sea, and therefore with seawater and everything else, the stone deteriorates, and it wasn't as nice as those things way out in the desert. Therefore, when people come here, because everything else in Syria is rather spectacular, they're usually disappointed unless they've done their homework. But by means of some slides, I can perhaps show you how this may well have looked. Here's our group. We're going into an actual palace of the king of Ugarit. What happened here, it was a French colony, that a peasant was plowing, and all of a sudden he bumped onto a statue. Well, at that time they simply told the colonial authorities, and the colonial authorities, they were very well organized, sent out an archaeologist, and the French had been digging here for over 40 years. Can you imagine that? And we have written materials from here, so that here, for instance, is the palace I just showed you here. There's a fortification, and see what these lines are. Here we've been digging. The rest has not yet been dug. Or here will be a section here in the upper town, and here would be the Temple of Baal, and here the Temple of Dagon. And right here is the priest's library. We find all the way that they talked about their own god, Baal. See, otherwise people only knew it secondhand from the bad mouthing of the Israelite prophets, when the Israelite prophets got after their people for worshiping Baal. But here you would have their own library. And this gives us a tremendous view. From the top here, you could look down into the harbor. Here's the harbor where all the ships would come in from all the sea. From my French archaeological magazine, I got this slide made. You can see that the way people lived in those days, the small little streets. But here they have a courtyard, and you have a well. Or here on a housetop, they're living nicely. They're kind of having their grain here and putting it together. They can cook outside there. And well, when I lived there archaeologically, we'd always watch Arab people, and it was kind of nice. They lived outside. It was very nice. By the way, they had running water inside here. They also had a good sewage system. So it was a very nice place to live. 1200 to 1000 BC, the time of David. And this is the newest construction of the temple of the god Baal. You came in, it's a skyscraper. And the reason they said it's a skyscraper is because you could see the harbor from here, see? And those are altars. But you came in here, and if they let you in, and you had to be pure and all that, then here's where the first altars were. A lot of these were ship people, and those are anchors from ancient ships. When they had a safe journey, they often said, we'll dedicate the anchor to the god Baal, the weather god who gave us good weather. And here you have pictures of Baal. We'll show you that ourselves in just a minute. And you could go into the lower part, but you can go up the stairs up here, and you can go all the way up here and have that too. So that's perhaps the newest reconstruction by the French people themselves. And this is the way they pictured the god Baal. Notice he's a young god, strong, vigorous. This may well be a priest of Baal here. We don't know that for sure. See, there's no writing here. He stands on top of the water, but you see that's underground water, which would be good, drinkable. But he's also fighting against the dragon, which lived out in the sea.
He's got a mace here to bash people's heads. He's got a helmet with horns on, strength, a dagger. And notice his spear is part of vegetation. He's a fertility god. Well, we know from this a little more than we would have known from the Bible. That Reader's Digest book that I called Great People of the Bible and How They Lived pictured, this is the worship of Baal and his consort Ashtaroth. It was kind of a sex orgy in part. They're only getting down to it here, and that's why the Israelites didn't want to have anything to do with it. They would, do you remember the time of when Elijah went against the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel? They cut themselves and lashed themselves. It was quite a different sort of religion. The Israelites didn't understand it on its own basis. They understood it only in the basis of the first commandment, that the Israelites should have nothing to do with any of these Canaanite customs. Well, here's the writing, actually, put in a little modern thing with a translation from one of their poems about the death of Baal. You see, when you had water coming down and impregnating the earth, then Baal was fruitful and crops grew. But then when the dry season came, Baal died. So, and then they would lament. And so here they'd say, Baal is dead. This is their cuneiform writing. B, that's a ul sound. That's a m sound, that's a t. Mote, Baal is dead. Who will be the people of the son of David? What's going to happen to the people if they don't get the ring? Who the mankind of Usher Baal? We shall descend to the earth with him. Thou shalt descend, O lamp of the gods, O shepherd, that's another god, until thou art sated with weeping, you shall drink like wine your tears. Psalm 80 in the Psalm says, the Israelites, in Israelite version said, you have made your people to drink tears. And so these are various expressions that were kind of common in those days. It doesn't prove the Bible, but archaeology in this sense gives us another city that was a great city at the same time that Jerusalem was. But the difference is that the Israelite stories have all been preserved in a living community, first the Jewish community and now the Christian community. We still have them in the church on Sunday. Whereas here we find this just by archaeology. And there is no, you know, worship of Baal today, although I think some people could understand it. People go for all kinds of things today. This, by the way, is how they would picture, this comes from a German magazine, which is quoting Psalm 74, verse 13. Du hast in deiner Macht das Meer aufgestört. You have, with your power, simply made the sea rise. Du hast den Drachenhäupter über den Wassern geschmettert. You took the heads of the dragon over the water and just smashed them to pieces. Du hast die Köpfe der Leviathan, the Leviathan, zerschlagen. You knocked the heads of the Leviathan to pieces. Du hast den Hain zu fressen gegeben, and you gave it this so that all the scavengers could eat it after it was dead. Now here, from a seal, from this place, you have a picture of, notice how many heads he's got. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Those of you were in class one day, I said, why 7? It shows that it's beyond just the natural, it's kind of supernatural. And in this whole story, when Baal fights against the Leviathan, the power of he's got a kind of a boomerang, you know, like they have in Australia, and he throws it 7 times, and he finally gets all the heads, but the guy always brings new heads, and so then he comes back to life, and so Baal doesn't conquer anyway, and Baal finally dies. This is the sort of stories they told. Well, my last slides, and I have only four more, come from a place just on the border of Lebanon. One of the reasons why Lebanon is so ununified is that it has all kinds of valleys like this. And on one valley, it'll be Sunnite Muslims. Next valley, it'll be Shiite Muslims. Next time, it'll be Greek Orthodox Christians who are connected with the Greek Orthodox. Next will be Syrian Orthodox. Next will be Maronites that are connected with Rome. Next, and they have no unity. And each valley is by itself. Now, this still was in Syria. And you can see there's new hotel up the top here. Over here is the old monastery that we visited. And in this valley, they still speak Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus. These people were never conquered by the Muslims. They were living back in this valley. And so the rest of the countryside was taken over by Muslims, but there is no mosque here. These are Christians. And in fact, this is a Maronite church, a Christian sect we don't really have in the United States here. And then up in the wall, there's supposed to be a church for Tekla, who's companion of St. Paul in the Apocrypha. This is not in our regular Acts of the Apostles or in his letters himself. And there are shrines there. In fact, I think this is the shrine inside. It happened to be that I was there on Easter Eve. And the abbot had only, he had no monks. He was the only really monk. And he had only...